Well, let's get back to the beginning, you know, because I was reading your bio pack. And first of all, like, freaking awesome bio pack. Like, we get people all the time. Like, I mean, we're outbound reaching out and talking to, like, Aaron Rodgers to get on the show. So we're trying to, like, reach for these golden nuggets. So yeah. 99% of the people that send a message in, I'm just like, man, I just, like... And truthfully, like, it's just my own ego. Like, I don't want to get stuck only talking to jiu-jitsu people, which is, that's my community in the MMA community. Uh-huh. But the people I find fascinating, yes, there's the jiu-jitsu. Yes, there's the backstories. But, like, I like the Gary Vaynerchuks. I like the people that are, you know, I like a lot of the same stuff Joe does, you know, the science and the nerd stuff. And it's, so Vinny was like, yo, check this out. I was like, man, this is so well put together. This is fantastic. So kudos to you on that, man, whoever did that.
That'd be my buddy Ryan over at it used to be the Grappling Central podcast. Now it's the BJJ Fanatics podcast. He's my boy.
Oh, okay, cool. The BJJ Fanatics podcast. BJJ Fanatics has gotten so huge over the last few years, man. Yeah, it's crazy. Like, he's making a grip of cash. If everybody that's working there loves BJJ Fanatics and keeps making those videos, like, you know, huge honor for me to buy Ferrari. You know, you know, like,
yeah,
crazy.
Yeah,
Bernardo.
I just met Bernardo a couple of days ago here. Actually, he was down filming an instructional in Orlando with Jacare, so I got to be kind of backstage on that one.
Oh, nice. You've got, like, so many things going on. It's funny because one of the things that I really liked when I was reading your bio, man, was, like, I always joke that I'm a jack of all trades, master of none, because I have so many, I have so many interests, right? And, like, some of them crossover, you know, having guys like Anthony Pettis on the show and stuff, like, they're big into the NFT space and the crypto space. And I am too. Like, I've been in the crypto space since, like, late 2016. I was a crypto nerd. Yeah. So, like, we actually just thought about making just a separate crypto channel because that's really where most of my free time mentally is spent. But I was reading yours and I was like, you got into NFTs. And then obviously because jiu-jitsu the Instagram page, and then you got rid of your house and you've got a family of six and you're traveling all over the place. Like, you got a lot on your plate, man.
Yeah, dude, it's a circus every single day, but it's cool. Like, the circumstances that brought us around to that weren't very cool, and we could go into the politics of that if you want, but really what's interesting to me these days is the silver lining that we got out of it. You know what I mean? Like, nobody wants to lose their gym, nobody wants to lose their house, but if you can pull something out of that rubble like this, where you get to take your family on the road full time, and that's, like, now your house, that's your lifestyle. It's not like a trip, this is my home, and we just plant it different places all the time.
Was that like a trickle down effect because of COVID and then the school and the house and everything else?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a long drawn out battle of attrition, to be honest, between government mandates, restrictions, lockdowns, shutdowns. It was never ending up in Canada. It's still going on right now. There's a whole thing going on up there right now with people not even revolting, just protesting all of the mandates and the restrictions. But I was stuck in that for like 16 months straight of just never ending, constantly changing, always, you know, ruining a little bit at a time, everything that I had built for, like, I was a pretty new business owner at that point. As far as gym owner is concerned, I'd been at it for about a year and a half. And then I spent the next year and a half under lockdown restrictions. So we didn't have a whole lot of nest egg built up at that time to sustain us. And one of the cool things that you're mentioning is all of the extra stuff that I do on the side, as far as the Instagram page, as far as instructionals. I've done some with Fanatics. I've done some other jiu-jitsu instructionals online. That has now, out of necessity during the pandemic, but now as a bonus, has become my full-time gig, where I make, the only income I make is online. And it's not an easy life, to be honest. It's a constant grind and constant hustle, but it is never not interesting.
You have a family of six, so that's you, your wife, and then four kids?
Four kids, yeah.
How old are your kids?
3, 5, 8, and 10.
Good for you. Someone asks me, and I have to, like, think for at least 3 or 4 seconds. I'm like, they're twins. I have to do, like, that dad math in a second. So, man, so you go from, like, opening a gym, investing all that time and effort, and just like any other business, I mean, it takes a while to build those residual incomes and stuff. COVID hits. I teach at the Henzo Gracie out here on Tuesdays just to help my buddy out. And that was my big concern too. I'm like, man, like, if there's one industry that's going to get really whacked by COVID, it's in your face, like, coughing, sweating on other human beings. And then, like, everyone's trying to navigate these ever evolving circumstances and you know, like, these different laws. And then there's the state laws, the federal laws, the Broward, you know, the city laws, the municipalities and stuff. And it reminded me of, like, the old days of, like, underground MMA fighting, where, like, people would be like, are you going there tonight? It's like, should we post it? No, don't post that you're going to go train. Just go train and shh, don't tell nobody. You know, like, it was crazy. crazy. So your gym closed down, and then how did you decide? Was it just out of, you said out of necessity, and you ended up having that shitty scenario where you lost your house. Was there a thought like where you were like, let's, what made you decide, let's fucking just travel versus let's try to get a downsized place?
Well, several different things. To be honest, like the whole grind to try to save this thing that was just not able to be saved was mentally taxing on a new level. Like it was a gulag for 16 months straight, where every week was, you're not sure what the next week is going to bring. You don't know how many weeks it's going to be before they change things. And it's always this never ending struggle that by the time that we finally had to close shop, we were ground to the ground as far as finances were concerned. We had nothing left. So again, out of necessity, the only equity I had left on God's green earth was the house. And I found myself in this situation where my wife was the one that actually had to come to me and be like, look, Drew, I understand that you're trying as hard as you can to keep us in this house and you're not willing to let it go. Because I wasn't. I mean, as you know, as a man, as a husband, as a provider, I was a sole income provider for my family of six. I can't lose the house. Like, that's utter failure. And she told me, look, it's just a house. There will be other houses in the future. We need to get some new footing. And there's nowhere else to go at this point. Like, I've got a journeyman ticket in welding. I've welded for 15 years professionally as my full-time gig before I'd opened the gym. But even that field was dead. There was nothing going on. There was no lateral move to make. So it was just a necessity. We managed to sell our house pretty fast, which was good because we had like a time clock ticking down until all the bills came in. We got rid of the lease on the gym. And at that point, we opened up enough to buy a trailer and a truck, which we've never used before. Before we bought this thing, we'd never had a trailer in our life. So there was a big learning curve there. And then just sort of step by step, took it out to a campground, took it out to my in-laws' ranch, and step by step moved it around. But the goal to get down to the States here was always something on my mind. When it got to the point that Canada had just crushed my business, I knew at that point, because all the time, all the while that was happening throughout the 16 months of this grind, I was looking down kind of with curiosity, but also with jealousy at certain states that were sort of sticking up for the little guy. You know what I mean? And we got none of that up here. There was a lot of arguing and a lot of bickering and a lot of, you know, nothing ever happened of it. The government says what the government says and you're just stuck. But I thought to myself, this gym is unfortunately done. I have to lose my house here. If I'm mobile, I want to go check out the US because if this ever happens again, or if I decide to start a gym again, I'm not doing it here again. It's just, it's a failed experiment that if for whatever reason they decide to pull this ripcord again, for whatever reason, I know that they will without any sort of remorse and crush me again. So I looked at all the different states that I would have rather been in during the pandemic while I was stuck in Canada and wanted to go visit them. So part of this is just like making up lost time of getting to see people, getting to meet people. I'm going gym to gym. Like I said, I'm at Ricardo Laborio's today. It's amazing getting around gym to gym and just getting that person-to-person interaction, which was literally illegal while I was up in Canada. Like they would fine you if you came into contact with someone of another household, $1,000 to $2,000 per person in each household, to the point now that I can go like to different cities, to different gyms, slap and bump, have a good time, get some stories, get some human interaction, not just for myself, but for my family. My kids weren't allowed to play with friends for almost 2 years, you know? So part of it is that, and part of it is sort of scoping out different environments and different societies and seeing if there's somewhere we'd like to put our roots down.
Are you like documenting all this, like recording any of it? Because this is a crazy story. I think you're going to look back on when, you know, you're 80 years old. Like, remember we did all that crazy shit when we lived that's gotta be so, like you said, you know, as a father and a provider, I can't imagine how nervous you were saying, okay, let's all pack up. And then that time that you said, now we're officially leaving. Now we're not just going to someone's house, someone's campground. Like, I got to make sure I make enough money to feed these guys, keep gassing this thing and keep going that way. Like, was that just like terrifying to you? And how did you like plan that out?
Yeah, to be honest, man, like anybody who's got the mind of an accountant would hate the way that I do it because a lot of it is just flying by the seat of my pants. And this will lead into some of these other projects that you had interest in where man, every single month is a new hustle online. Like you can't, there's very few ways that you can rely on a steady, passive, reliable income to support that just out of thin air. You know, that's a long build and I'm not there yet by the time I had to rely on it. So whether it's I'm coming out with a shirt or I'm coming out with a rash guard or I'm doing this new instructional or, you know, trying NFTs, I had to try to make something stick every single month. But this is something that I was already doing in the pandemic because the gym was shut down. And even though the gym was shut down, we weren't allowed to use it, I still had to pay for it every single month. So I had to sort of magic hat $5,000 to $10,000 out of my ass every single month to try and make it to the next month, hoping that the restrictions were going to be done. So I kind of built this new grind set of how to do this online with the social media following that I have, to the point now that I'm fairly competent. I wouldn't say I'm a master, I'm no Gary Vee right now, but I'm fairly competent in being able to leverage what I have as far as my community into just enough to keep us going and maybe a little more along the way.
That's funny. I love that grind set. I'm going to steal that. I'll give you credit. That's a, that's great. That's a great way to look at things. It's funny because, you know, you're in Florida now, so you can see that, like, Florida in the US, we're like the college party town. Like, they're like, everyone's got COVID. Like, it's all right. Just go have fun. Go cough on each other. We don't give a shit down here. Like, Florida is one of the most relaxed states in the US. I remember I went up to New York to visit my my buddy Vinny at one time, and like, it was, Florida was the opposite. I mean, we were like, no masks, and you go to New York, and it was, they were still eating outdoors, and masks, and restaurants had like 25% capacity. And I was like, holy shit, this is crazy. This is like living in a movie. Like, I was finally just mentally able to get out of here. And the, it's funny that you came to the US, because my joke with everyone here, and it's a lot to do with this, the American politics, and just, you know, I mean, we had Donald Trump. At least Canada never had Donald Trump running its shit, you know? Like, yeah. now we've got this 90-year-old geriatric that keeps calling the vice president the president, and I'm just like, I'm moving to fucking Canada, man. Like, everyone that I've ever met from Canada is fucking awesome. Like, Ryan Reynolds, like, man crush. I'll go there. He's cool. So how did you decide, like, what areas and you were going to come in the U.S.? Did you just haphazardly go, let's just throw it at a dartboard? Or did you have these jiu-jitsu relationships and you're like, let me go start to kind of ping around?
Yeah, that was mostly, to be honest, how it started, was just people that I knew online that I'd never met that I wanted to go see them in person. And I had friends starting in Montana, which was directly south of where I was in Alberta. So we just head down to Montana, met my friends there. We went down to Utah, met my friends there, down to Arizona. Same thing. We just kind of traveled around gym to gym with kind of the community that I had built already online, but now we were doing the IRL version where we got to go hang out, train and eat. And it's a totally different experience, you know? And like you're saying, I was documenting a lot of this, at least to the lead up of getting over the border, which is a crazy situation in and of itself. There is so much red tape when it comes to crossing the American Canadian border right now, especially coming from Canada into the US. It was extremely difficult to do. And I wasn't even sure we were going to be able to do it, which is kind of a weird story, because we had to, not only because we wanted to go down and check it out, like I was saying, but the Canadian winter was coming behind us. We had to cross around the October mark, not only because the weather was changing, and you can't winter in an RV in Canada. It's minus 40 degrees Celsius. You can't do it. So we had to get across the border. There's a lot of red tape, a lot of unknowns about that, plus our beloved leader Justin Trudeau, who made it his mission to try to scare tactic everybody into getting vaccinated, made this announcement that November 1st, nobody who isn't vaccinated is going to be able to fly on a plane, going to be able to go on a train, going to be able to go on a ferry, any sort of mode of transportation that is personal, you're just not allowed to do it. So myself and my wife, we aren't. And for multiple reasons that really don't even matter to the conversation. It should be everybody's personal choice, in my opinion, which is hilarious that I have to like couch that as an opinion nowadays. But that's what the whole struggle is now up in Canada. But meanwhile, we were looking at this like we've got a deadline to get across, because we can't drive across the border. It was illegal to drive across the border at that point. The only people that could do it were in semi-trucks that were considered essential, you know? Everybody else got turned away. So we had to find a way to drive our unit across the border without actually driving it. We found a friend of ours who was a jiu-jitsu student of mine when I had the club, who's an American citizen. It turns out that he could drive our unit across because they couldn't deny him entry into his home country. And we just had to get a letter from a lawyer saying that he was allowed to drive our unit across. But then we had to fly our asses down and then meet up with the unit on the other side, which involved the timeline of getting down before November 1st, before we're supposedly not going to be able to fly ever again. You know, it's everything is indefinite when it comes to these things. And there's PCR tests. All six of us had to get PCR tests, which if they came back negative or if they came back positive, we couldn't fly. There's all these cogs in motion all at the same time that had to go perfectly to get across. And long story short, we finally got across. Everybody got across safely, happily. And we spent like $4,000 to $6,000 in this process between PCR tests, plane tickets, rental cars, paying all sorts of different fees to get across. And it's just, it's so silly that this invisible line between our two countries that are so similar in many ways becomes this line of contention now just because of the politics.
Yeah, it's insane. So like, you know, obviously they didn't make vaccines mandatory, but they've circumvented enough things, like you said, travel, where they're effectively making it mandatory. Like if you want to go about your life, it's like, we can't tell you, you have to get vaccinated, but if you want to use running water, you have to be vaccinated from here on out.
Yeah.
Was there like a mass exodus from Canada, knowing that November 3rd was this kind of looming date, where a lot of people are like, shit, I got to get stuff going beforehand?
There was definitely in certain circles, they were getting very worried. And part of this too was, one thing that a lot of my American friends don't realize that I had to come to grips with in real time was leading up to this was a election for the prime ministership that was called early by Justin Trudeau. And a lot of my American friends don't realize that there's no term limit on prime minister in Canada. He can be in as many times as he wins. And he had already been in twice and he was going for his third term. And what was weird to me though, was during his pre-election run-up, one of the talking points that he decided he was going to make a priority that was going to help him get into the prime ministership again was basically villainizing part of his population as the unvaxxed. And he would literally threaten people over and over and demean them. And part of that was this plan to stop them from being able to be part of polite society in whatever way he decided to at the time. But one of the things that really changed my mind, and we actually bumped up our dates to get across the border, was he started using language while trying to get elected. So this is, again, something that he thinks is going to be so beneficial to his election chances that he's going to use this as a point of contention, is he said that those people over there, he was outside of a anti-mandate rally, he said those people over there are putting our children at risk. And when he said those words, I caught the nuance in that and read between the lines and said to my wife, actually, she was the one that showed it to me. And it kind of hit us both in the face. Like, look, they're changing this game to the point that we have to worry about our children being taken at this point, because if their children are at risk, by definition, our children are at risk because of our choices. And if this comes to the point where social services are coming to take our kids, we just can't be here for this. We gotta get out of this shithole.
Wow, that's crazy. That, like, when you come down from Canada, are you guys on like some sort of a passport? Do you have like a ticking expiration that you have to go back, or what's the plan for that?
Yeah, so the way that we did it, any Canadian can come down to the U.S. for up to 6 months as a visitor. Most people just use like a couple of weeks to go to Vegas, but you can go up to 6 months. So we're on that right now, and we're like 4 months in. So we're heading back from Orlando back west and north as the snow clears up. But we got to be back before the 9th of April. But we are in the works of trying to find a visa to help us stay down here more permanently. And a particular one called an E2 visa seems to be the way to go, which requires you to start a brick and mortar business, which is part of why we're looking around at different places to see what we want to do. But to sort of bring it back around to these hustles, is one of the biggest prerequisites to getting this E2 visa is the ability to show proof of capital somewhere between the tune of $80,000 to $100,000 that you can, you know, support this business in the, you know, 5 to 7 years that it takes to grow this thing. And we had nothing, you know, so part of coming down here was also trying to build up a nest egg to the point that we could support this option. And again, it was all fly by the seat of my pants, trying different things, lots of irons in the fire kind of deal to figure out what would stick. And coincidentally, I had been in the crypto space not nearly as long as you. I wish I started in 2016. Since about 2020, my buddy got me into it when there was just nothing going on in the economy. Everything was shut down. He's like, yo, you got to check this Ethereum shit out. This thing is going to be the future. And he got me on board and showed me all the ropes. And so for like a year, I was playing with crypto coming into 2021. But in the summer, I started noticing things in the community of crypto move towards NFTs, which was new to me. I didn't know anything about this in about the summer of 2021. And I did about 2 or 3 months of due diligence of just trying to learn everything I could about NFTs, to the point that I got to around October when we were about to leave. I started building the art for what was going to be my first NFT collection for Because Jitsu. As it turns out, there's a lot that goes into that, not just making the art, but a whole lot of computer savviness that I didn't have, that I had to sort of bootstrap myself and learn on the fly. But come to the beginning of December, I put together a 1 month marketing run up to what was going to be the release for this NFT collection, not knowing if it was going to do anything. Like, I got a lot of pushback from the community, to be honest, because it seems like 90% of the human race doesn't understand what an NFT is and is all of a sudden just hostile against the idea. They're like, this is a scam, this is a scheme, you're some guy trying to take everybody's money, and they don't understand how this JPEG equates to anything of value. Part of that 1 month was trying to convince people that it is and it does, and so there's a lot of education. But then, I mean, from my side, I didn't know if I was going to sell one, and this was my entire possible income for December. We were coming up to January, and I was like trying to budget craft dinner because we didn't have anything to really fall back on at that time. And to bring it to the end of that story, I not only launched my NFT collection successfully, but I sold it out in a week and made essentially the amount of crypto to fiat that it takes to get that visa all in 1 week.
Wow, that's crazy. Have you thought about doing like, and we'll go back and talk about that in a second, but like, and a lot of people don't, you said 90% of people don't know about NFTs. I think there's 90% of people that think they know about NFTs, 90% don't have any clue, and the other, you know, non-fungible tokens and the utilities and stuff. But like, why did you decide that was a way that you wanted to go? Was it based on the fact that you have this community built around Because Jitsu, and then how can you kind of monetize that? Or is it more that you were just a crypto nerd and the two kind of fell into place together?
Yeah, kind of the two at the same time, where I was a crypto nerd. I saw the potential there. I saw people winning in that space in big ways. And I don't know, I did enough research that people convinced me that it was worth trying. Like, Web3 is here to stay. It's burgeoning. You got to try it early. You got to do something. And I knew that nobody in the jiu-jitsu space had really done it at that point. So I had this strange opportunity to be first to market. I'd never been first to market for anything like this before. So I don't know, man. I got a little bit of a personality where I'm willing to try shit, whether or not it's good for me. It might be what got me into martial arts to begin with, what got me into MMA, things that like sane people might not want to do as a hobby. I wouldn't say that I'm risk averse necessarily, but to a degree, I should say I'm not risk averse. Like, I'll take a lot of risks that people won't. So between those two things, between the community already being built and Because Jitsu, as well as my interest in just throwing this shit against the wall and seeing if it sticks, I'm glad that I did. I'll put it that way. And I've had, ever since then, a lot of people have been coming to me to try to get some sort of like roadmap to do the same thing. And I think that this is still just beginning. This is just growing. Like, I think 2022 is going to be 10 times what it was for NFTs in 2021.
Yeah, that's crazy, man. From conception to launch, how long was that process for you to get the NFTs on OpenSea?
Conception, as in like, I just had the idea to try it, was like in August of 2021. I did the art sometime around September, October. It took me a few weeks to do that. I learned all the way along from August on, I'm doing my own research in the actual space, trying to figure out like all the marketing tactics. What's really cool about this for anybody who's like an entrepreneur or into marketing is it really is only limited by your imagination. There are so many different ways that you can get people to invest into something that you're offering, and many different like collaborations of those ideas can come together to make some really interesting ideas. So I guess at that point, I learned a little bit of coding, which was necessary to figure out how to generate these things, because they're one of these collections that are programmatically generated, which is a big fancy word for I used a computer code to put all of my drawings into, that were split into layers. So if you picture like take, for instance, a monkey. Everybody knows these monkey pictures out there. You've got something that has no face or no clothes, and then you'll have different layers for the eyes, different layers for the mouth, different layers for the hair, different layers for the clothes. And this program basically rolls the dice on every time that it spits one of these things out of what's of each of those layers it's going to pick. And so in a really cool way, you can kind of just plug this code into your art and pop out. I did 420 because I'm a meme page and 420 is kind of an internet joke. I did 420 of them in like, I think it popped out in like 5 minutes, you know? And for me to do that personally, to try to individually figure out all the different layers for 420 different images would have taken me months, and I'd probably still get duplicates. So it was a really cool factor is doing the programming side of things. But then to finally answer your question, I guess from inception to completion was from late August to late December, so about 4 months.
That's crazy, man. So if you had such a high level of success with the NFTs, is there a reason why you just didn't make that a full-time gig or?
Well, I'm still like, I sold it out at the beginning of January. So we're still less than 4 weeks removed from that. Well, about that, about 1 month removed. And since then I've started planning a second release. I'm helping about 5 other people with their releases. So it kind of is just, it naturally matriculated into my full-time gig. I still like jujitsu is still my full-time gig as far as what we're doing, driving around and meeting people and training. But NFTs now, not only is there so much space to continually have success in it, but the success when you have it is so much larger than anything I'm used to. Like the amount of capital in the crypto space is bizarre. Like it doesn't make sense. Yeah,
it's strange fucking mind blowing, isn't it? Like
it is. Know,
like, Pettis was on the other day and he was like, okay, so I was big on utility tokens. Like the first thing I looked into was Bitcoin, and then I liked all the smart contracts and stuff. And the reason I really got into crypto was, you know, you can make a pitch or an argument for anything from, hey, open a bar or a restaurant, a jiu-jitsu school, and you can make some very clear, concise counter arguments. Well, if you don't get enough of this, you're not going to have that. And the more I looked into Bitcoin and the more I looked into crypto, the more I was like, you know, the counter arguments really aren't that sustainable or valid. They're really just, a lot of them stemmed from a lack of due diligence, people just not understanding. And I think we see that at least from our government and them trying to put regulation around it. But going back to how much crazy money it is, I think the crypto market now is like $2 trillion today, and it's still in its infancy. So many people are like, oh, I don't want to get into it. But, you know, I missed the boat to a large extent on NFTs because I was abreast of them back when Bored Ape Yacht Club was launching and back when like... Back when like Mutant, Bored Ape Yacht Club and what was the other one, man? Space CryptoPunks. Yeah, when CryptoPunks were like, I remember friends that were getting them free as airdrops, and I was like, I don't want this fucking. I don't know. They're like, oh, you got to open a MetaMask wallet, bro. You get a free like CryptoPunk. I'm like, what? This is an ugly Mario looking JPEG. What the fuck do I want this thing for? Oh, now I remember because it's worth $2 million. That's why. But it's crazy because like Anthony Pettis got on, and he's big into crypto space too now, and he bought something called CloneX, and there's so many of these new things. He spent, you know, I think it was $7,000-$9,000. He bought it for, and he just sold it for $250,000.
Oh, my God.
There's so much money. And the crazy thing is like people don't know where to put it. There's so many different places now where these NFTs and, you know, you talked about Gary Vee. You know, Gary Vee launched his whole line of NFTs and Gary Vee friends. And, you know, they had some utility to them where if you got this one, you could, you know, gift goat, you get a gift and all these other things. But it really is mind boggling because people, you know, we talk about like, I love to hear how people are like, I'm an entrepreneurial hustler myself, right? Like I love the idea of being able to, you know, like take a situation like COVID. And I think it's a pivotal time in people's lives because if you're a house builder, right, you can't go out and build houses right now, or you can't run your jiu-jitsu school. Some people either they deteriorate or they thrive under those. And I think the idea of being able to kind of sit home and figure out how can I make these things, crypto is a huge space and it's still so early in that space. And that's one of the things I've constantly kicking myself in the butt for is like not getting into the NFT space. But again, I think it's so early. When you're traveling the US, are you meeting a lot of people in the BJJ and MMA space that are also into crypto? Because it seems like that demographic overlaps a lot.
Yeah, it's strange how much it overlaps. There's these strange little like sub niches, almost like a subreddit to the thing that you like anyways, that I've come across tons of people that are into it. And they're the ones reaching out to me now because they see me do it publicly on Because Jitsu, and a lot of people are following me there anyways. So they're like, yo, what's going on with this? How can I do this? What? Tell me more about it. You know what I mean? And the thing that, to speak more to like the strange amount of wealth that is in crypto in general right now. I think, like, I pondered this for a while, especially after I sold my collection out, which I had never thought was a sure thing. In fact, that was like the best of all cases scenario if I was going to sell them all. I'm like, well, I'm never going to sell them all, but I'm going to try to sell some. And I sold them all. I was like, what the hell? Because this is the wildest thing. So I had essentially between $90,000 to $100,000 worth of ETH in 1 week that I didn't have the week before. And it all came, I had 420 of my NFTs that all came from 245 people. So that is not a large community to all of a sudden have $100,000 pop into your wallet from. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
sure.
You don't need to be a Gary V size following to have some legitimate income come in. And I was thinking about this. I'm like, people are not going out to get three extra jobs to afford NFTs. Where is this coming from? That they either had this money they weren't willing to spend until now, which makes less sense than anything. I'm like, why would they want to spend three times more than they'd spend training on this JPEG that they think is going to be worth more in the future? What I think it is especially people who adopted crypto earlier than the NFTs popped on, like yourself, like people that I'm running into that are like, yo, I just made it good on Shiba Inu last year. I ran into a guy who's a black belt under Eddie Bravo. And he said, yeah, I bought 12 of them from you because I just had a lot of Shiba sitting around that I moved into ETH and got your NFTs because I think they're cool and I think they've got some potential in the future. But look, he didn't spend a lot of actual hard-earned money on that. You know what I mean? He spent value. He spent value through crypto, but he wasn't like this dumb millionaire that just dropped a bunch of money. There's a lot of people in the crypto space that are sort of like serendipitously rich in crypto. And they are the ones that are willing to take risks and sort of throw it around a little bit more than people who are like old world investors that are trying to gain 1% on their stocks over the year. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and that's like, yeah, the old the Berkshire Hathaway logic of buy Coca-Cola, airlines, and credit cards and be happy with 8%. That's the thing that's crazy is that I talk to people now, and I had a friend of mine just the other day reach out to me. He's like, man, you know, like real estate or crypto, what do you think right now? Where's the better buck to be spent? I go, well, look, real estate is at its all-time high. Crypto is doing a pullback of 50%. I mean, that's on sale in my opinion. And like the real estate market can only get so big. The crypto space, I think, is fundamentally changing. And we're still, everyone, you know, we see these crazy gains, right? People get into Bitcoin and, you know, they put in $100 10 years ago. Now they've got $15 million. And everyone's like, I want to see, you know, like they have this super short-term attention span. Like if I didn't make my 5,000 and 10,000 in 30 days, I'm fucking pissed off. It's like, go back 10 years. You'd be lucky if that 5,000 turned into 10,000 over 7 years, you know? So like, it's crazy to see that overlap. But like, you know, like one of the things that I think is really cool about the whole crypto space is not only is it like fundamentally changing anything and allowing people to like to live outside of the box, but you know, like you've got these NFTs and these new forms of art, and like it's really going to change, I think, like everything from television to media to, you know, like Ben Mezrich, who's an author that we just had on. He did the movie that was the Facebook movie, that the Social Network. He wrote the book about that. He wrote Bringing Down the House, which was the book that became 21. And he just did an NFT launch, you know. So like everyone is really getting into this NFTs, and it's so far in advance of being crazy. One of the things that I read a long time ago, and did you ever play poker?
Yeah, well, a little bit online, nothing serious.
Because, I played poker a lot and I was very passionate about it for a while. And like one of the things that once you get to a certain level is you have to have a certain risk appetite. And typically what I read is that poker players do really well in the crypto space because they have a pretty high appetite for risk to reward. And a lot of those people that are that old money, like our parents' parents that are still putting that money into like the 401ks and they're happy with, oh, I got 15%, super excited. That money hasn't really trickled down yet into the crypto space. And we're seeing just kind of all of that generational money flip around and flip over. One of the cool things, man, is like, obviously, BJJ, at least in my opinion, has always been one of the more, I mean, it's an expensive sport to do, right? Like from the gis to like, you know, most of the places that you're training, it's not like there's a karate school everywhere. And at least back maybe when I started, there were only a handful of jiu-jitsu schools. So they were charging a premium dollar to go do these things. So there's probably a little more overlay too of overlap of the people that are like, you know, in the jiu-jitsu space, having a few extra bucks, younger. How old are you?
I'm 39.
39. Okay. So we're like about the same age. I'm going to couple that into the same age. I'm 41. We're going to say that's close enough. Yeah, it's close enough. So like, okay. So right now you're down with Ricardo Laborio in Florida. is your plan to hit a few more jiu-jitsu schools and just head back up to Canada, or are you going to start releasing the second?
Well, I kind of have to because unless I surprisingly have my visa that I need before April 9th, I just legally have to be on the other side of that border. Otherwise, I'm considered an illegal immigrant. And if you spend one day past that 6 months down here, they'll never let you back in again. So there's just a very hard timeline. They're very specific about that.
Have you looked into like P1 visas, like athlete visas and stuff?
What's that about?
A P1 visa. I'm pretty sure P1 visas are like when athletes need to get visas that are to like do like sport competitions in the U.S.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know if that's. I've
looked into some of the athletic ones, and to be honest, they're so particular with the U.S. If they're bringing you on with an athlete, as that's like the prerequisite, you're an athlete, you better be like a multiple-time world champion, because, you know, anybody can be an athlete. Yeah. They want to bring in the best of the best. If you have something that says Olympic behind your name, then that's probably enough. But if you're just some jiu-jitsu black belt, they're like, what is jiu-jitsu to begin with, and why do I care?
Right.
It's not a place. Like, I started with an immigration lawyer with that. I was like, yo, I'm a jiu-jitsu black belt. I've got this qualified skill that I can pass on. And she's like, okay, how many world championships have you won? I was like,
Well, I plan on getting a lot. Yeah. Like, well, let's say I'll be 40, so I can do the IBJJF master's division here in a few months. But that's funny, man. I guess the one thing you got to say, like the weather in Florida, you can't crush that versus like, it's been so nice here. My buddy that moved down from New York, he's always calling up. There's like, yeah, it's 30 and snowing. You're like, ah, no, I'm not down here, man. It's beautiful. How far down south are you coming? Are you going to Orlando and up, or?
Yeah, this is as south as we're going this trip, unfortunately. We just got this timeline. We got 2 months to get back, and we spend like anywhere from 3 days to a week at a given spot. So we got to start sort of heading back west and then north. I would love to spend more time in Florida. The problem is we're just like diagonally opposed from Canada on the west down to Florida in the east, the southeast. It's just the furthest state away from us. So unfortunately, that was just the furthest we could get in the time period.
Are you going to hit the formerly known as Danaher Death Squad up at all in Austin, Texas, or the B team?
I already have, actually. Yeah.
Oh,
I
got okay.
To so... go. Yeah. We spent about a month in Austin, partly because it is this new mecca for jiu-jitsu, but also it just seems to be a new mecca in general. Like a lot of people have been moving from these really hard hit blue states, whether it's New York, whether it's California, down to Texas, because they're like, yo, freedom, bitch. And everybody figured out that's good enough for me. And then they you know, pulled roots. Joe Rogan moved over there. Elon Musk moved over there. All these like movers and shakers moving, and everybody's kind of following their wake. So partly I wanted to go train with all these guys down there, and partly I just wanted to see that area. Like I want to assess for myself, is this really what everybody thinks it is? And so I went down there. The first person I trained with was Danaher at the Henzo Gracie there, Henzo Gracie Austin. I've been friends with Gary Tonin since 2014. We've known each other through some competitions. I ran some tournaments up in Alberta where I brought him in as a competitor. So we were on talking terms, and I was like, yo, Gary, I'm in the area. Could I go train with you guys? Like, yeah, come down to the Henzo Gracie down here, meet John. We've got some competition training at a different place, but talk to John first, because that's pretty like exclusive. I was like, oh, okay, cool, cool, cool. So I go down there. It's a typical class. John is an amazing teacher. We did some no-gi stuff. We did a little bit of strangling afterwards. And then I sat down with him. I was like, hey, John is such a weird guy, man. Weird in the weirdest way too. Like funny, weird, but also just weird, weird.
Yeah. There's a few like, yeah. He's definitely the kid that sat alone in the lunchroom when he, but like doing like astrophysics at like 9 years old or something. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So I sit down beside him and I'm like, hello, professor. My name's Drew. I'm a friend of Gary Tonin's. He said to come by and ask you if it would be all right if you guys need an extra body in the competition class that you guys are doing later. And he looks at me without introducing himself stoically and says, Gary has no friends. And I didn't know how to take that at first. So I was like, well, I guess I'm an acquaintance that he WhatsApps from time to time. He said, yes, Gary did mention that you might come by. And for sure, we could use an extra body over at the competition class, but he neglected to tell me whether it needed to be a live one. He doesn't even crack a smirk when he says these things. So I'm like,
yeah, you can't tell when he's kidding or not. I know it's nuts. You know what I'd love to do an interview is I'd love to interview every girlfriend John Danaher has ever had. Like, what's it like dating John Danaher? Like what's that dude's bedside manner? Like, he's like, I wonder if he's like this crazy, like sexual guru with girls and just has all this, like, I figured out that 36.2% is the correct angle for penetration in order to reach a maximum. I have a whole system. John Danaher Connor's doggy style system. That's going to be the next release he has. You know,
it's going to go live on Pornhub.
Yeah, yeah. How to put the third hook in. but, you know, yeah, Danaher is a crazy cat. I've only trained with him a couple of times when I went to Henzo's. And what I was always taken aback by with John was, like, his ability to teach gi and no gi simultaneously. I don't know if he was doing that down by you, but he would have a gi top on and shorts, and half of his class at noon would be coming in and doing gi. He'd show a gi move, take it off, go into the next thing with the no gi, and then he'd be micromanaging kind of both. And like, my brain can't bifurcate that well. Like, usually when I'm teaching a series of stuff, it's like I know I'm going A, then B, then C, and I want to keep on this track, and he's going two different directions. I'm like, man, this guy's crazy. And everyone has those stories where this guy John Danaher would wear rash guards to weddings. I mean, like, no one in the history of mankind has seen John without a rash guard. Did you also get a chance to train at B team at all, or just with Danaher?
Yeah, so after I went to the competition team, which was crazy, there's this, like, it's a private facility they don't really give out the name or location of, so I had to go through this whole, like, vetting process even just to find the place. But I trained there with John, Gordon Ryan was in the room, Gary Tonin, Oliver Tazza, and George St. Pierre, just on a typical Tuesday, you know what I mean? It was wild. But then the other gym that I definitely wanted to hit was B team with Craig Jones. And so I dropped him a note on Instagram. He said, yeah, absolutely, come down, come check us out. And totally different vibe, man. It's sort of strange to think that they came from the same team, because his vibe is like typical Aussie, you know, it's just like really relaxed, always like joking around and sort of ribbing all the other guys, just making fun of them the whole time, but everybody's kind of in on the joke. Whereas Danaher was like very, like, I don't know, clean and precise and official, you know? So it's very different training, which I guess doesn't surprise me why they split off, but I enjoyed both of them in their own ways, to be honest.
Yeah, it is kind of weird. I mean, that really, it was like mom and dad got divorced to the jiu-jitsu community, right? Because Danaher's Death Squad was so prolific in terms of really, I mean, you know, in winning the EBIs and going on to just be like kind of in the forefront of like the leg lock movement and stuff. And then all of a sudden this whole team breaks up. And you had Nicky Rod on, and I don't want to get into, like, I'm not going to speculate on why, but, like, obviously having these two separate teams now, they do have a very different training mechanisms and the way they approach it. What I think is interesting is that Nicky Rod was very adamant about, like, I want to compete against Gordon in the ADCCs. Did you get a chance to train with Nicky at all?
Yeah, actually, he was teaching the first class I went in on, which some people might think weird that the purple belt's teaching the room, but you've never met Nicky Rod if you think that's weird. Like, I got to actually do a drill with him right before sparring. So everybody was partnering up and I was kind of like the lone duck for a second. He's like, yo, come over here, do it with me. Where you start from behind him standing with like a seatbelt around his waist. And the goal is to try to take him down. His goal is to stand up. So it's kind of like this wrestling drill. Dude, if I could reach around him and like close my hands together, that was impossible. Like, I could get a couple of my fingers locked. He is so thick through the trunk, it doesn't even make sense. I've never experienced a human that's like that isn't fat, you know what I mean? Yeah. He's just solid muscle like a tree trunk, and it was wild. He moves like water too. It doesn't make sense. I understand why he's fucking everybody up at heavyweight, because he doesn't feel like a heavyweight.
Yeah, well, it's funny, because when we first spoke, he's the only person that I've ever talked to that he was like, yeah, I did jiu-jitsu for like 2 weeks before I did my first tournament, and he was competing against black belts and beating the shit out of black belts. And the average person, right, like, I think that there's a certain, I don't want to say chip on your shoulder, but like, once you finally get to be a black belt in jiu-jitsu, you feel pretty confident. That just, like, my joke was always like, I feel okay going to a bar because the guys that can kick my ass, I know them, or at least I know who they are, right? Like, most of the time, I'm okay. But you see a guy like Nicky Rod, like, you wouldn't ever imagine some guy who was just a wrestler with very little to know. And he wasn't like a D1 All-American All-Star, right? He was a solid wrestler, super athletic, and he's crushing black belts. And he just kind of glossed over that. I'm like, that's a huge, like, I think his ceiling is really high. And, you know, I've talked to people on the show about, like, between, you know, because obviously Gordon Ryan has talked about potentially doing MMA with one, even though I don't think that's going to come to fruition. But Gary Tonin has had a lot of success. And I always thought that, like, the guy that has the highest level and ceiling there is Nicky Rodriguez. He's super athletic, like, has a gas tank that just keeps going. It's crazy. Did you get a chance to roll with him at all?
Not actual sparring, no. But I got a chance to roll with his younger brother. That was kind of interesting because he's, like, I guess the beta version of Nicky. He's not nearly as big, but he's exactly the same style. And I was again, shocked with how good this guy was. He legitimately passed my guard in like 3 minutes, which is a pretty hard feat for most people to do. And he's at like a blue or purple belt level right now. I'm like, Jesus, where do they get these kids from? Like talk about a ceiling.
Yeah, that's good. Is it just cardio, just out of control, just that wrestling mentality?
Yep, cardio, pace, but also his technique is sharp. Like, it wasn't sloppy in any single position. You know what I mean? Like, everything was tight. Everything was precise, which is so strange. It feels like black belt technique, which is so wild.
Hey, did you ever go roll with Gordon Ryan?
No, they're a little picky who rolls with, like, the elite guys. I got to roll with Gary because we were friends. Didn't roll with Gordon, didn't roll with GSP. But I did actually go to Tim Kennedy's gym, which was fun, and got to roll with him. Talk about a fucking monster. Oh, my God. That guy's like a steamroller with a gi on.
That's funny. You know, I'm just curious because you didn't get a chance to roll with those guys. But do you see, I mean, you have obviously Andre Galval and Gordon Ryan have that super fight coming up. And that's probably the most interesting matchup that I've seen lately for Gordon Ryan. But I am curious, do you think if a Nicky Rodriguez can bring anything to bear for Gordon if those two competed?
If it was this year, I don't know. I think it's still a little early because, like you're saying, his ceiling is high, which means he's got more growth potential. I feel like Gordon is pretty close to his ceiling. Like, he may have some growth left, but he's already like the apex of the sport. Mm-hmm. And like, I think there's not a whole lot more beyond him. It's hard to tell because nobody's really beyond him at this point. But for Nicky, like, he's got so much for him to have the idea that he can beat Gordon in a full-on competitive jiu-jitsu match right now, and he's a purple belt, and he might be right. That's pretty crazy. I think 3 to 5 years from now, he's going to be the next Gordon.
Yeah, and it's crazy too because Gordon even still so freaking young. It's not like he's even thinking about retiring. But I know that, you know, what I always thought was very telling was that when Nicky and Gordon broke up, Nicky Rod went to the B team, and everyone's like, he's like the genius master, he's the John Danaher of the B team. Was he there teaching it all, or did you hear anything about how he's, because I mean, I guess the question I have, right, is like, Gordon Ryan loses amazing training partners, and arguably Craig Jones and those guys lost an amazing instructor. So how do they both compensate for that? Did you see any of those kind of working themselves out while you were there?
That's a really interesting insight, because thinking back retrospectively, it is very much like what you're saying, that the Danaher room feels like the apex coach, and the B team room feels like a whole bunch of competitors. You know what I mean? Like, it's competitors teaching competitors, whereas in Danaher's, it's like this savant psychopath teaching competitors.
Savant psychopath. That should be Danaher's new Instagram handle. Speaking of Instagram, how did you start Because Jiu-Jitsu? And that's a hilarious page with, I mean, you guys like Rogan and stuff follow it. And how did you start that? What was the thought process behind it?
To be honest, I started it when I was still welding. I was a purple belt at the time. And talk about politics, not even like provincial or government politics. BJJ's got so much politics in and of itself that, especially usually around that purple belt level, most people start running into it. And I was like, I was running competitions, promotions, and like interacting with a lot of different teams, and came in contact with a ton of these politics. And they started to really negatively affect me, particularly with our gym, where we were under a big organization that was sort of stifling our growth. We couldn't afford to bring their guys up from the US to belt us. And we were a small gym, and ended up for like 2 years, nobody got promoted, to the point that I was like, man, I don't know if I'm ever going to have a brown belt in this sport. I don't know where I'm going from here. And I got really down. Like, there was this weird elongated plateau where I felt like there was no growth potential. And it was the first time since starting jiu-jitsu in 2007 where I legitimately had the idea of like, I might just quit. Like, this is shit. This is turning into shit, and I might just quit. And I got really like down on the whole community and the whole sport. And I made this meme page on a lark mid shift while I was welding one time. I'm like, I'm going to make fun of jiu-jitsu, and I'm doing it out of a place of kind of spite and malice at that time. But a weird thing happened as I started throwing out all of these memes that were making fun of jiu-jitsu. I had a whole ton of people that were responding to it. It was like, yeah, that is true. We are stupid. You know, there's like this weird commiseration where it was like, oh, it's not just me. This isn't just a me thing. This is, everybody goes through this. And it actually kind of saved my BJJ career, to be honest. And it grew it at the same time, because as we all kind of like laughed at ourselves, and we're allowed to laugh at ourselves, it became this giant community of like, yeah, like we all enjoy this nerdy get together in weird pajamas and we strangle each other in unicorn onesies and this is normal to us and that shouldn't be normal. And I think that everybody's a little cooler in this community for that, but we can't take ourselves seriously. And that's kind of how it grew. And it just grew naturally at that point in a way that I wasn't expecting. I wasn't trying to do it. And I mean, what a weird flash forward. If you were to tell me like 6 or 7 years ago that this is what that would have become, I would have told you to stop drinking. You know, like there was no way that's what that was going to become. And it's become my whole life at this point.
So do you spend a lot of time on there like looking for memes or do you just create them yourself? Or how do you manage like the content posting for something like that?
Yeah, so with Because Jitsu, one of the things I'm most proud of is I've never missed a single day posting an original piece of content. Every single day, I've had a new piece of content for almost 7 years at this point, which was, it kind of keeps me in the grind, to be honest, because I don't want to break that streak, so I just can't miss a day, you know what I mean? But it's gotten to the point now just from practice, just like jiu-jitsu, just like any skill set from practice, you get so good at doing these things that I can pop a meme out in like 3 to 5 minutes any given day if I just take the time to do it. I'll find some picture that speaks to me on Instagram or on Google and be like, yeah, that could be a jiu-jitsu meme, and I'll have the wording and figured out and posted within 5 minutes. It's really not that hard.
Yeah, you need an algorithm like for NFTs where it just spits out 420 memes for you. You don't have to think about it. You can just hit the upload button and it's all done, man. Do you prefer gi or no gi?
I've done majority gi, but I really love no gi. I just did a no gi class with Laborio and it's so fun. You know, like jiu-jitsu with the gi is my passion because it's my specialty, but jiu-jitsu without the gi is like, it's like candy. It's like dessert. You know what I mean? It's so much more fun and I wouldn't say less technical, but you can get away with a lot of shit that you can't in the gi because everybody's got grips, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like I'm the opposite, man. I started training jiu-jitsu in 1995 and then I was with Eddie Bravo for years. And then when I had my first fight, I had my first fight in 1998. So like I took the gi off forever because there was that old adage like, oh, well, you know, you don't need to train in a gi for MMA. And also we were at a place, I was at a place too, that was a JKD school that had a hard time finding ways to like promote guys because it was, you know, like we'd bring in Henzo once every other year and it was really kind of like limited. So like Carlson Gracie's and stuff. So it was, for me, it was the opposite. Like, putting a gi back on, like when I went to, I was talking to Henzo and I was like, man, you know, like I've had over the years, several people offer to give me black belts, but I never wanted one of those, like, you're my buddy. We've been training together for a long time because you can submit me. Here's your black belts. And like I was on that 15-year brown belt program or some shit, you know, like, and I just, you know, like, so I was like Eddie's, like first brown belt, I think, or Gerald Streepin was back in the day. And like I went up to Henzo's, I was like, fuck, I got to put a gi on. Ugh, I was terrified because the opposite, you know, I remember, so I put a gi on. And like I overcompensated for gi technique. The good thing, right, is like no gi, a lot of the mechanisms, the overhooks, the underhooks, the control, the wrestling aspect will translate to a gi. And if you're at a good enough level, you can kind of defend most of the, like, you can sniff out the stuff that's coming. It's harder to move, it slows your game down versus taking a gi off and trying to go, where are all my fucking handles? But man, I remember the first day I went up there, right, I had to go buy a new gi. My finger, first of all, I left there, my forearms were like, they looked like He-Man action figures. Like I was like, I couldn't open my hands for like a day. And my fingertips, like, because I was just didn't realize how much I was gripping so tense and so hard and so non-fluid in jiu-jitsu, like, had no skin on my fingers. And I'm like, yeah. I don't know if I really want to do jiu-jitsu anymore, man. Like, this is tough. And then Henzo, of course, like, I talked to him, like, on a Tuesday, and he was like, ah, boy, come to New York, my friend. No one deserves a black belt more than you. Come to New York. I'm like, great. So Thursday, I fly out there, and I went to the Thursday night class, and he wasn't there. Oh, yeah, I'm going to be here tomorrow. So I show up at the morning class, and he's not there. And I'm like, what time is Henzo getting? They're like, you just are 1 or 2. I'm like, all right. Hung out, you know, ate some sushi. 2 o'clock, nothing happened. Oh, I'm going to come tonight. And then he doesn't respond. So I went to every class for 4 days. Didn't see him. I'm like, fuck, man. And then finally, the day before I'm going to fly out, I missed an afternoon gi class. He's like, hey, poja, where are you at? I'm like, figures. You know, so I'm like hopping the train and like rushing to get there and shit. And then naturally, I get there at the end of the gi class. And I got my gi on. Now I look like this putz who doesn't give a shit, right? And I'm like, I've been here every class, man. You know, so it was funny. I finally got the black belt. Then like, I didn't have a speech prepared, so I just ad-lib some shit. And so, but it was fun. Henzo's a great guy. He's like Laborio, man. Like, yeah. Like, in Laborio's got such a freaking wealth of knowledge, especially, like, I think he's the most brilliant MMA mind. I mean, he's the reason that American's Top Team started, you know, with the whole BTT and Dan Lambert and stuff coming to the States. That's crazy, man. Have you got a chance to roll with Marcelo Garcia at all? He's another guy with one of those crazy thick waists and no grab.
No, I've done a seminar with him once in 2013, and I mean the guy's a legend. You don't need to ever roll with him to know how great he is, but I would love to just to experience that, you know, because there's this thing that people that roll with him, I'm sure if you roll with him you could probably attest to this, that his grip is just otherworldly, you know. Like I tell people, like you can have a guillotine, but it's not going to be a Marcelo team. You can try the Marcelo team technique, but it's a totally different creature when he puts it on these people, how fast they tap.
Yeah, it's what's crazy too is like you look at a guy that had, for me, Marcelo Garcia is the GOAT. Like I was like, I modeled a lot of my game after Marcelo Garcia. Like I really like idolized, because I was never a super athletic kid. And I was never super flexible like Eddie. And Marcelo was never a super flexible, super great wrestler. He developed a lot of butterfly guard and arm drags. And that was always like, ah, yes, I love this stuff. And I had a chance to roll with him when, you know, he was starting to get into mixed martial arts. And what's crazy is you see a guy who's so dominant at that level and didn't have a lot of success in mixed martial arts, kind of had this, it's a different game. People don't realize like gi to no gi is different. No gi to MMA is different. It's, you have to, you know, there's, I think Carlson Gracie Sr. had a joke that you want to make a black belt a brown belt, you punch him once. You want to make him a purple belt, then you punch him twice, and you know, like 5-6 punches in his first day. And I had a chance to roll with Marcelo, and he was at ATT in Coconut Creek, and I had talked to my buddy Dean Thomas, who I lived with Dean for a couple of months prior to my last fight in 2008, and I was like, man, what's it like rolling with Marcelo? And he's like, man, like you, that old lady across the street there will last longer with you than you'd last with Marcelo, right? Like, and part of me was like, that's his sense of humor. But also I was like, and it's crazy, man. Like when you say that there's varying levels of black belts, like it's insane. Cause like, I've never rolled with someone that I really just couldn't get. And I've rolled with like, you know, some of the top black belts. I could always at least at bare minimum, even if they're better, I could get something going. I can create a scramble. I could get in a little, I could make them a little dangerous somewhere. And then get my ass kicked. Marcelo was like, man, he just grabbed you and you don't give him a submission. He just takes submissions. And like, it was so crazy. I mean, it's such another world, but it's such a pleasure. And that's why, like, I almost wish guys like Marcelo would, and you know, he's obviously past his prime now, but I'd love to see like a Gordon Ryan, Marcelo Garcia, like two of the best mind matchups ever kind of go in there.
Yeah. I mean, those styles of matchups, thankfully for us, is they kind of did happen down in Brazil in his time. You know, he fought Hodger Gracie, he fought Shanji Ribeiro. There was people that were like the other side of the coin goats that he had great matches with. Galval, I think, at one point.
Popovich a couple times.
Popovich, yeah. There's, I mean, tons of times that he got to prove against the sort of the up and coming Gordon versions of their day. So I don't. It's always unfair to people like that out of their prime to be like, yo, go fight this new guy who's coming up. But I understand that, like wanting to see it happen. But at the same time, it's kind of sad when you see it happen in reality. Did you ever see that video that came out of Keenan Cornelius rolling with Marcelo Garcia?
They were in a gi, right? And then I can't remember, to be honest, at this point, but it was
Kenan, security cam footage.
Yeah, I think I did see that. And was Kenan like narrating over it or something? Or there was some, I remember watching some video with Kenan and him rolling, and it was, but yeah, the security cam footage.
Yeah, it just made me sad, man, because Marcelo was already long past his competition career, and Kenan was up and coming. He was a Baron Polo master at that point, knew killing everyone black belt, and he took Marcelo's back with this Baron Bowler or something. I was like, ah, man, like I didn't need to see that. Like, let me keep my hero for God's sake. Stop beating him up. You know, so for that reason, I don't want to see these old versus new matches, because like it kind of takes away a little bit of the reality of when they were good. Right. Like, time is a son of a bitch, you know, and it's so unfortunate to try to take away a bit of that legacy.
Yeah, it dulls the sheen a little bit. You know, I think that, like, and not to negate, like, the Hodger Gracies, who are some of the other GOATs, but, like, the thing that's, I think, is different is that there's, the way that Danaher approaches jiu-jitsu is very systematic, where you don't see guys like Gordon using a lot of scramble strength, and Marcelo really didn't either. He was very systematic too, but I'm just curious in terms of more of a stylistic, like I'd love for there to have been like an Ultimate Fighter for jiu-jitsu, where you just took like two great coaches, guys that didn't have, and everyone was on the same page, and you just taught them for six months, and then you could kind of refine and see, right? Because from an MMA perspective, and you've done MMA, we kind of know that, like, look, if someone says I want to get into MMA, we need need to know how to wrestle, you need to know jiu-jitsu, and you need to know like some sort of a striking that's efficient, like Muay Thai or American kickboxing. Like, it'd be interesting to see kind of from a jiu-jitsu perspective, is it better to teach wrestling for 6 months and then 10% grappling or 10% for, you know, defense, or is it better to just work on this first? Because I think, you know, Danaher is really one of the first people that have really said this is the system versus, like, I remember you could order Carlson Gracie Jr. VHS tapes, and the one VHS tape was blue belt requirements. Then you get the two test tapes or purple belt requirements. I'm like, it's like, what, like in five tapes you could have a black belt? Is that basically what we're saying here? So like now you've got thousands of hours, but I always thought that something like that would be interesting. I'd watch it. Maybe you can start doing that on Instagram stories for us.
Oh, that would be amazing. That it's really interesting because I was just listening to Danaher recently on Lex Friedman's podcast. He was on with George St. Pierre and Gordon Ryan. Yeah. It was a really interesting episode. And one of the themes that kept coming up when Danaher would answer questions was, what is the most efficient technique, the efficient, most efficient way to learn, fastest way to learn? He's like, look, you can get into the sauce with any technique or version of techniques for your entire life and come out with very little as far as skill set is concerned, because there's just so much to focus on. So he's like, what I like to do is, we only have so much time on earth and even less time on the mats, is spend as much of that time as efficiently as possible to get you to a usable version of jiu-jitsu that can be competition efficient. So I think like taking that mindset would be really interesting, to take some know-nothing white belts first day for 6 months, train them and see who's right. What system brings you to the most competition efficient version of a fighter with different body types, with different mentalities, different strategies, but using the same system.
Yeah, that would be interesting, man. You said you were, just to wrap this up, I know you said you were initially kind of documenting your journey. Do you have a YouTube channel that you were doing that on, or how were you doing
that? You can check it out, because Jitsu has its own YouTube channel, and I had a vlog series I was running up in Canada. I didn't really continue it down in the States, but it was called North-South Chronicles. So you can check that out. It's kind of a play on words with the position as well as the geography. And I don't know, I really enjoyed doing it, and you can check me out there. You can check me out on Instagram. I've got a personal page, drew.weatherhead, as well as the meme page, because_jitsu. And check out the NFT collection too, because they're all owned at this point, but people are putting them up, and there's a lot of utility behind it if you're into jiu-jitsu that you might like. So check out Ape Shakas, Shakas with a Z at the end, on OpenSea. And I mean, join the club.
Awesome, man. Well, thanks for taking the time, and appreciate whatever Walmart let you use their office space to do this for a little bit, and appreciate it, man. Hit me up on Instagram. And if you ever do make your way down here, let me know. I'll take you and the fam for a, well, I guess I can't take everyone for a beer because they're too young. So we'll take you and the wife for a beer. We'll buy some healthy junk food for the kids.
Beautiful. Thanks a lot, Jason.
All right, man. Take it easy, brother.